We need to be continually reminded of the simplicity of prayer. I love that song. It's a reminder that, you know, there's a real blessing in being reminded by God on a regular basis of our weakness. Paul said, when I'm weak, then am I strong. And it's as we recognize our complete weakness that we go before the throne and we find grace in time of need. What a blessed song. Well, hope you had a good Mother's Day and a relaxing Mother's Day. We should also say a welcome to Abby, who's back with us, and we want to congratulate her for finishing college. It seems like a long time ago that I graduated from college. I was thinking it's almost 20 years ago, and I'm getting old. But I remember that day well. It's one of those places where you have a complete change in your life. So, but we want to welcome you back. Let's continue looking at Daniel as we continue or kind of wrap up here in the next few weeks. Our study of eschatology from the Old Testament. And we've been looking at the 70 weeks of Daniel, a somewhat enigmatic passage that has puzzled people for centuries, literally. It is a very interesting passage, to say the least. And I want to look at it. We looked at the prayer last week in the first part of Daniel 9. And that prayer that Daniel gave, which covers most of the chapter, this 70 weeks prophecy was an answer to that prayer. And in that prayer, Daniel was asking for the Lord to restore Jerusalem and forgive his people, Israel, and restore the sanctuary. And God, or the messenger, Gabriel, came back with an answer. And that answer was this 70 weeks prophecy. And we need, if we're going to understand this prophecy, we must understand it in the context of the prayer, but also of the book of Daniel. I was reading, I have, I think, 11 commentaries at home among everything on Daniel, covering, I think, every position available, probably. I'm amazed as I read most of them this week, at least 9 of them, I know, but at least, and then looking at each one, and I was amazed how little time they spent talking about the context of Daniel. Because the answers to the problems are in Daniel. And it's almost like they dealt with this prophecy as if it was just dropped out of the sky. And they didn't do it completely. There were some who dealt a little bit with the context, but very little, I must admit, in regard to the whole context of Daniel. So I want to look at it in that regard. But let me just step back and explain a little bit of what I want to show you and my purpose here. And this is why I'm using this to sum up what we've said all through this past year in regard to the Old Testament. When you look at the Old Testament, it is pointing to constantly, continually, from beginning to end, that consummation when Israel's sin would be removed and Israel would be blessed. That is just the whole Old Testament is looking toward that. Now the Jew, looking forward, could not see the separation between the cross and the kingdom. They didn't. They knew they needed their sins atoned, and they knew that the kingdom was coming. They did not see two comings of a Messiah. What they were looking for was that day when their sins would be removed and when the kingdom would come. That included the Messiah reigning on a throne in Jerusalem. That's what they were looking for. They didn't know about the cross. And what I want to emphasize is that what most commentators do, and especially all millennial commentators, is they read the cross back into this prophecy. This, while what is accomplished in this prophecy was accomplished at the cross, that's not what it's pointing to. It's pointing to the ultimate day when the kingdom would come, which is what the whole Old Testament is looking to. And what I want to emphasize is that everything here, and I think this is, and again, I don't want to be too simplistic, but I think this is obvious in the context of Daniel. I think I can show that tonight. That everything that Daniel's pointing to, that this prophecy is pointing to, is the fulfillment of that kingdom. That day when the wrath of God would be turned away from Israel and they would know blessing. That's what this whole thing is pointing to. The day of the Lord, the day when Israel would be judged and Israel would come into her glory. That's what the whole thing's pointing to. Now that's the overview. Again, that was the Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant and the new covenant were all pointing to that day. They were all pointing to the day when Israel's sins would be removed and they would come into the glory of the kingdom. That's what it was pointing to, the day of the Lord, which we've talked about. Now that's my overview. Let me look, we want to look tonight at just verse 24. And I want to read, just if you have your Bibles open there, to Daniel 9:24. Now I must admit, I mentioned this morning, this is a phenomenal verse. Every single word in this verse is significant. Every phrase is filled with meaning. It is a phenomenal verse. And as I studied it, it just all kind of comes together. But let me read it and then we'll talk about it. And hopefully the challenge in this is always to make it clear and to bring everything together. But let's look at verse 24. It says, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Now let me just give you three things here to start. The first thing I want you to notice, this is kind of review, but a time period is given. 70 weeks. Okay? A time period is given. A time period that is decreed on a particular object. That object is Daniel's city and Daniel's people. Okay? And the third thing is, notice that there are six things that are going to be accomplished at the end of that 70 weeks. In other words, at the end of that time period, these six things will be accomplished in relation to Daniel's people and Daniel's city. Israel and Jerusalem. The Jews and Jerusalem. And those six things are: finish the transgression, make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Those six things will be accomplished at the end of these 70 weeks. Now let me deal with those three things in order, and hopefully I can get through this. I won't cover this in all the detail of the notes. I don't think I'll... let me just deal in a summary way in regard to the time. Okay? I won't go through every... Well, I'll deal with this a little bit. The time element, the 70 weeks. As I mentioned last week, it's literally in the Hebrew, sevens, 70. The sevens comes first, which is abnormal. It actually says sevens, 70 are decreed on your people and on your city. Now, the word seven, technically, is a word that is generally in the Old Testament translated weeks. Okay? It refers to a period of seven. And it is generally used in relation to weeks. And most of the it's not used that often, but where you use it, like 90% of the time in the Old Testament, it's translated weeks, probably more than that. And it simply means a week of days. But the word itself does not necessitate a week of days. It literally means a period of seven. And so it could technically be 77s of days. It could be 77s of weeks. It could be 77s of months. It could be 70 sevens of years. Okay? It doesn't say. It just says 70 sevens. Translated 70 weeks. But we would, well, let me just give you the argument for the fact that these are weeks of years. I think this is pretty conclusive, but let me just give you a couple reasons. Number one reason is the 70 automatically brings to mind Daniel's prayer in the first part of the chapter. You remember back in verse 2, it says, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, observed in the books the number of the years which were revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet for the completion of the desolation of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. In other words, it was written in the book of Daniel. We saw this last week. Daniel was reading in his book of Jeremiah, and this prophecy that was written by Jeremiah was written in Daniel's day. He was reading the prophet Jeremiah, and he saw that there were 70 years decreed to this period where Israel would be desolate. You remember that Daniel's in the captivity here. The leaders of Israel have been taken to Babylon, and the temple has been destroyed, and the Jews have basically left. I mean, Jerusalem is desolate. And Jeremiah prophesied that it would be 70 years. And so Daniel, reading this, prays, Lord, you have said 70 years. And he prays for the restoration of his people to the land, to Israel, the forgiveness of their sins, and the rebuilding of the... He talks about... He prays for his face to shine on the sanctuary, which was desolate. Okay, so he prays in relation to that promise. And the answer comes back, 70 sevens are determined on your people. So it is revealed to him that there is another period. That this 70 years has ended, but now there's another period determined, decreed on the people of Israel. And so the 70 sevens, obviously, in some respect, harkens back to that 70 years of Daniel, or of Jeremiah. The second thing we would point out is that the original 70-year captivity of which Daniel was reading in Jeremiah was God's response, you remember, to their not obeying what? What didn't they obey? The Sabbath year, remember? The calendar of the Jews, based on Leviticus 25, the calendar of the Jews was based on a seven-year sabbatical cycle. Every seventh year, the land was to rest. And every seventh sabbatical year, there was a year of Jubilee. And it was because they didn't obey this Sabbath year, they didn't do it. He says, because you've disobeyed me, the land, you're going to be expelled from the land, and the land is going to have its rest based on the sabbatical year. So you understand, when you say sevens, it could well refer to the sevens of years in the sabbatical year of which the 70-year captivity was speaking. And you could see that, by the way, in 2 Chronicles 36:21. We saw that last week. We won't turn there. But so it would seem natural to take these sevens to be sevens of years, in other words, with the sabbatical cycle in mind, and with Jeremiah's 70 years in mind. Okay, if that makes sense. The other thing that we would point out is that within this new period that Daniel's given, the temple would be rebuilt, destroyed, and rebuilt again. Verse 26 and verse 27. Something that would require more than 490 days, 490 weeks, or 490 months. Everything seems to point to the fact he's talking about 490 years, or 70 sevens of years. 70 times 7 years, which is 490 years. Now there's a confirmation of this. Forgive me, I know it's detailed, but that's okay. God is a detailed God. There's a confirmation that it's talking about years. And without going into too much detail, the confirmation is this. If you look at verse 27, and we won't look at this in detail, it says, "He will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week." The last week, the 70th week, okay, he says it'll be for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. Now, I think he's talking here, he talks about then on the wing of abomination. The abomination of desolations takes place in the middle of that week. Now, what's the middle? What's halfway of seven? 3.5, okay? That time period, 3.5 years, is given several times in Daniel and the book of Revelation as a period that measures, A, how long the Antichrist oppresses the Jews, and B, how long the temple in the book of Revelation is trodden under the feet of the Gentiles in Revelation 11. And not only is it given as 3.5 years, a time, and half a time, it is given as 42 months, which is 3.5 years, and it's given as 1260 days, which is 3.5 years. That suggests that he's talking about years. It confirms it. And that's basically the point. So in the end, I think it's 70 weeks of years, 70 times 7 years, 490 years. Now, the only other view that we would say is conservative, and that what I mean is evangelical, would be the amillennial. I don't know that every amillennial takes this view. I just know that E.J. Young does, and E.J. Young is probably the commentator of amillennialists on the book of Daniel. And he takes it on page 94 here, simply, I'm not sure even exactly I could really express what he means by this. The reference is to an intentionally indefinite designation of a period of time measured by the number 7, whose chronological duration must be determined on other grounds. I'm not even sure what he's saying there, but what he's saying, it doesn't mean anything. In other words, he's saying this doesn't really reflect any duration of any particular period of time. It's just a designation, which makes it wholly meaningless. And the division wholly meaningless. And in fact, what he does is when you go through his commentary, he actually takes these periods as it's divided up and he makes them totally of unequal length. They're not even proportionate. Okay? It's totally arbitrary. And I don't know how he justifies that. But Leon Wood has an excellent rebuttal to that. He says the only view the cause for rebuttal is that weeks is figurative of periods of definite lengths, as held, for instance, by Young and Kyle. This view makes the definite numbers 70 or 7, 62, and 1, which is how it's divided in the prophecy, as applied to divisions within the total 70 weeks, hard to understand. Why should indefinite numbers be applied to periods of indefinite lengths? That's a great question. It makes the prophecy meaningless, is what I'm trying to say, in regard to time. So I think the only logical way is to consider this as years. But at any rate, that's how I would understand it. Now, the next thing I would speak of very briefly is the object of these 70 weeks. These 490 years are determined on Daniel's people and Daniel's city. I'm not even going to take much time to say two things. It's obviously referring to Israel and Jerusalem. And if you read the prayer that we looked at last week, Israel and Jerusalem and Daniel's people are referred to over and over and over again. I mean, that's Daniel's prayer. His prayer is for them. He talks about the desolations of Jerusalem. He talks about Judah, inhabitants of Jerusalem and Israel. Israel transgressed thy law. And it's all about Israel and Jerusalem and Holy Mountain and the sanctuary. So it's obviously, it's talking about the Jews, and it's talking about the nation of Israel, and it's talking about Jerusalem. So, 490 years decreed on the nation of Israel, the Jews, Israel. Which leads us to the third point. And I suppose the most controversial. The accomplishments of these 70 weeks. What is accomplished in the 490 years. By the time we get at the end of the 490 years, what is accomplished? And they are, this is page 95, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now let me just point out, all of these refer to Israel, the Jews, and Jerusalem. Again, the amillennialists will point to these things and say it's referring to God's people in general, and they'll apply to the church. It doesn't make sense that way, and I think I can show that. It's referring to Jews. It's referring to Jerusalem. These are the things that will be accomplished in relation to Israel. Now let me just point out that the first three are negative, the last three are positive. It's to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity. And then the last three are positive. Bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up vision and prophecy, and anoint the most holy. Now the all-millennial view is fundamentally that these six things were fulfilled at the cross. Now you understand, let me just leave it at that. They would understand that all six of these things were fulfilled when Christ died on the cross. Young's quote points that out. I would respond to that in just a few ways. Number one, none of the six things were fulfilled in relation to Israel and Jerusalem at the cross. None of them. The events of verse 26 and verse 27 take place after the cross. If you look at verse 26, it says, then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who has come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. That's talking about AD 70 when the sanctuary will be destroyed. And then it talks about desolations are determined. And then in verse 27, it talks about the 70th week, which is after the crucifixion. And it talks about the middle of the week, stopping sacrifice and grain offering and so forth. My point here is that the things that are in verse 26 and verse 27 are actually a negation of the six things listed. The sanctuary hasn't been cleansed. None of this has been fulfilled. Righteousness hasn't come in. They're still in desolation after the cross. Because the cross is right after the 69th week, but before the 70th week. So my point is, it's not fulfilled. Right here in the prophecy, it's not fulfilled, if that makes sense. I would point out that the six things that are spoken of were made possible by the cross. Or they were, in a sense, they were purchased at the cross. But they were not fulfilled at the cross in relation to Israel and Jerusalem. Jerusalem to this day is in desolation. Jerusalem to this day is a reproach. The Jews to this day are scattered. Now let me, in the time remaining here, give you a contextual approach. And why I emphasize that is because this is what, honestly, I don't think any of the commentators really do well. They don't deal with the context. I want you to stop for just a minute and think about Daniel's prayer. Think about what Daniel was praying for. That's the context of this whole thing, of this 70 weeks prophecy. What was Daniel praying for? Verse 16. He was praying that God's wrath would be turned away from Jerusalem. Verse 16, he was praying for the end of the reproach of the people of Israel, the Jews. They were right now in captivity as a people. And he was praying that the reproach would end. That their sins would be forgiven, that the wrath of God, which was poured out on them as a people, would be removed. Which, by the way, is a reference to atonement. Turning away of God's wrath is what atonement is. Verse 17, the blessing of God on His sanctuary at Jerusalem, the place. Verse 18, the end of the desolation of Israel. It's the same word that's used in the prophecy. That desolation of Israel is what they were experiencing even right then. They were desolate. The land was desolate. The city was desolate. The sanctuary was desolate. He was praying for the end of that. And he was praying in verse 19 for the forgiveness of their sins. Now all of those things point to the new covenant. I'm not going to take the time to go there at this moment to Jeremiah 31. But all that to say, that's what he's praying for. Now maybe even more to the point, let me look at the context of Daniel, because I think this is definitive. In the context of Daniel, I want you to think about this. What would you expect this period to coincide with? What I mean by that is this, and I'll show you this. When you, all the way from all the visions of Daniel, from the beginning, from Daniel chapter 2 and the vision of the big image, all the way to the very end when Daniel's, when an angel is talking to Daniel, Daniel chapter 12, there is this constant looking to a point of time, a completion. That word is used throughout the book, completion. The completion of, the completion of, the completion of. And it's always pointing to the same thing. And it gets more detailed as you get to the end. And that thing is the end of the Gentile kingdoms, which is the first one, the image. Remember the image when the stone cut without hands is thrown and destroys that image, and that stone turns into a kingdom and fills the earth. Okay? So the end of the rule of the Gentile kingdoms. The coming of God's kingdom. In chapter 7, verse 13 and 14, when the Son of Man appears and takes the kingdom, and takes the kingdoms from the Gentile kingdoms. He destroys the Gentile kingdoms. He takes the kingdom for Himself. Look at chapter 7, verse 13. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. He's talking about the Messiah coming to his kingdom. This comes when the other kingdoms end. Notice, these kingdoms don't coincide. God's kingdom doesn't reign alongside of the kingdoms of the world. They come after they're destroyed. The third thing that this whole book is pointing to is the destruction of the little horn, the Antichrist. That's when, I mean, that's kind of the whole point here in these visions. That's when this image is destroyed in Daniel 2. That's when the Son of Man takes the kingdom for himself. And if you look at chapter 7, verse 24, he speaks of the little horn. What does he say? As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. This is the Antichrist. Verse 25, he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Most High. He will intend to make alterations in times and in law. And here it says, they will be given into his hand for how long? 3.5 years. That's half of 1 week. What happens in the middle of the week in the prophecy of the 70 weeks? The abomination of desolation, which is when the little horn begins to persecute the people of God. How long? 3.5 years. What happens at the end of the 3.5 years? Verse 26. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Verse 27. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. That's the same as verses 13 and 14. What I'm trying to get at is all of these things coincide at the same point. the destruction of the kingdoms, the coming in of God's kingdom, the destruction of the little horn who had just spent 3.5 years persecuting the Jewish people. Same time period mentioned in Revelation 12 regarding Satan persecuting the woman. It's the same period of time, 3.5 years. It's the same time spoken of in chapter 12, verses 6 and 7. It says, "And one said to the man dressed in the linen who was above the waters of the river, 'How long will it be until the end of these wonders?' I heard the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river as he raised his right hand and his left toward heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it would be for a time, times, and half a time, and as soon as they finish shattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed." That's the end of the tribulation. That's the time when the little horn's destroyed. That's the time the kingdoms are destroyed. That's the time when the Son of Man takes the kingdoms to himself. That's the second coming of Christ. That's when the little horn's destroyed, Revelation 19:20. It all is summed up there. Now, when you're looking at the whole book of Daniel and you're going through all these prophecies, they all talk about this fulfillment, this end point. It's all the same end point. Now, don't you expect that this 490 years ends at the same point? I mean, that's just logic. Not one commentator even suggested that. I think it's obvious. It's pointing to the exact same thing. And the 3.5 years mentioned twice, mentioned several times in the book of Revelation regarding the same thing, fits perfectly with the 70th week, which is divided into two. This isn't rocket science. It's all in the context of the book of Daniel. The more I study this book of Daniel, the more it is overwhelmingly clear. These things come together. This 70th week is still future. Now, let me just take a minute and put a couple things together. This 70th week, this consummation of when this little horn is done persecuting Israel, okay, at the end, that's when Zechariah 14 takes place. Turn over to Zechariah 14. I'm trying to put all this together for you. Now, we looked at these passages throughout the last few months, but I want to put them together in relation to Daniel. "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord," verse 1 of Zechariah 14, "when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you, for I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half the city exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights in a day of battle." The Jews will be at the point of annihilation. The Jews have still, in their future, their worst day ahead. It is this day. They will be on the virtual edge of complete annihilation by the Antichrist, which was prophesied in Daniel 9, or in the book of Daniel. It says he will persecute God's people. It's Revelation chapter 12, when he talks about the dragon will pursue the woman into the wilderness. For 3.5 years, God will keep her from being destroyed. But this, Zechariah 14, is Christ's second coming. And when he comes to deliver the Jews from the Antichrist, who has gathered all the nations of the world under him against Jerusalem and against Israel. It says in verse 5, "You will flee by the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains will reach Azel. Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him." That's Revelation 19. "In that day, there will be no light. The luminaries will dwindle." And then down in verse 9, it says, "And the Lord will be king over all the earth. In that day, the Lord will be the only one, his name the only one." That's exactly identical to Daniel 7:13 and 14, when the Son of Man comes down and takes the kingdom. It's after the little horn is destroyed, the Antichrist. And when the Jews' persecution comes to an end. It all works quite well. And actually, we could look at Joel 3. Joel 3 says the same thing. The amount of repetition in the Old Testament in relation to this is phenomenal. Now, as we look at these, I want to look at these things individually. I emphasize the context because I think that when you look at Daniel, these things coalesce, they come together when you look at the whole context. But I want to look at each of these individually briefly in what we have left here. And I'm going to suggest, now this, I must admit, this is at least in part, not all of it, part of it is unique. I'm not going to be dogmatic about everything. This is how I understand it. I thought this is amazing, to be totally honest. So many things come together here. I want to suggest three things are here. First of all is the cleansing of the sanctuary, i.e. the temple. The second is the removal of Israel's sin. And the third is the ushering in of the kingdom. That's how I would summarize these six things. And forgive me, I always, everywhere, whenever I study Hebrew now, I look for a chiasm. I just look for it. If it's there, I mean, I realize that sometimes that can be subjective. But I see chiasm here, and there are several things that I think point to it clearly. And I'm going to try to explain this briefly and hopefully clearly. And by the way, this is the reason I think many of the commentators go wrong. They see the first three as a group, and they see the last three as a group. I see chiasm. And when you have chiasm, you group the first and the last, the second and the second to last, and the two middle. And that creates a totally different scheme. I want to suggest that the first and the last go together to finish the transgression and to anoint the most holy are both speaking of the sanctuary. Why do I say that? Let me just begin by pointing out the transgression. It says to finish the transgression. Now, most commentators want to make this to be sin in general. I think that's unforgivable. There's something here that they ignore. An article. It doesn't say transgression. It says the transgression. It's the only one of the list that has an article. The transgression. Now, again, I'm not an expert in Hebrew. I'm not an expert in language. But English, or you know, language 101 is when you have an article, it's definite. It's true in English. It's true in Greek. It's true in Hebrew. When you have an article, it makes it definite. It's speaking of a particular transgression. The word, now this is interesting to me. Now follow here. The word transgression is one of the most common words for sin in the Old Testament. This word, pasha. It's a word that usually, they go together. Transgression, iniquity, and sin. Those three words go together oftentimes in the Old Testament in relation to sin. You find them together in Leviticus 16, 21 in relation to the Day of Atonement. That goat would bear away their sin, their transgression, and their iniquity. One of those words is transgression. That's the word here, pasha. Now, I find it very interesting. I don't want to make too much of this, but I do find it very interesting. Two of those three words which are in this prophecy, all three of them are in this prophecy, in this verse. Two of them appear frequently in Daniel's prayer in chapter 9. Sins and iniquities appear multiple times in his prayer. Transgression does not. And in fact, he uses another word that's translated transgression, which is related, but or it's a similar meaning, but it's a totally different word. But it's a word, I think this is ironic, it's a word that I couldn't find another place in the Old Testament where it's used to mean transgression. Almost as if this word isn't there for a reason. It's odd that it's not there, I think. What is interesting is this word transgression is only used one other place in Daniel. And it's used with an article. And it's in Daniel chapter 8. And it's speaking of a very particular transgression. Look at chapter 8, verse 12. It's talking here about the abomination of desolations. Verse 12. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform it its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression, there it is, transgression with an article, the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the most holy to be trampled. Now my point is this. If you look, I did a search for how often transgression is used with an article in the Old Testament. It's not very often. It's only a handful of times. This is unusual that an article is used with transgression. It's referring to a specific transgression. That transgression is the abomination of desolations. When the Antichrist ends the sacrifice in the middle of the week, and when he sets up an idol, the beast, as it's talked about in Revelation 13, in the temple. That's the transgression. And when he says bring an end to the transgression, he's speaking about the end of the abomination of desolations. That's the end of the 3.5 years that's talked about throughout the book. The transgression, the abomination of desolations, which, ironically enough, is where the prophecy ends in verse 27. The abomination of desolation. It's perfect. Not one commentary mentioned it. Not one commentary suggested that this transgression had any other thing to do than just general sin. And I can't figure that out. Plus, it fits perfectly with the chiasm. Because the bottom half, the very last thing, is to anoint the most holy. The most holy is given by commentators as the Messiah. But it can't be the Messiah for this simple reason. This phrase always refers to the temple, the tabernacle, or the instruments in the tabernacle. It's used 34 times in the Old Testament. It refers only to the temple, the tabernacle, and the instruments in the tabernacle. The sanctuary. So the negative side, when will the transgression end? The positive side, anoint the most holy place. He's talking about the temple. He's talking about the last verse, verse 27. The end of the abomination of desolations, when the Messiah comes and destroys the little horn, removes the desolation, purifies the altar, and blesses the sanctuary, which is what Daniel prayed for in verse 17. Turn over to Ezekiel, chapter 43. Because this is what Daniel was praying for, and this is what I believe anoint the most holy is referring to. Verse 1, then he led me to the gate facing toward the east. This is the temple that is described in Ezekiel that's never been built. I would call it the millennial temple. It says, and the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the way of the east, and his voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory, and it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when he came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision which I saw by the river Chebar, and I fell on my face. Now let me stop there. Ezekiel begins with a vision of the glory of God. And Ezekiel, you remember, Ezekiel is taken by vision to the temple. This is at the time, just before its destruction in 586, just before that. Ezekiel sees and observes the glory of God leaving the temple. He actually watches it go from place to place and then leave. It left the temple. That was right before its destruction. Now here in chapter 43, he's talking about a new temple with total new dimensions, totally different, never been built yet, still hasn't been built yet. And he talks now about that very same glory coming down into this temple. And that's what he's talking about. He's talking about the Messiah coming and bringing his glory into this temple. Verse 4, and the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate facing toward the east. Every Jew would have brought together this with the coming of the Messiah. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. Then I heard one speaking to me from the house while a man was standing beside me, and he said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell among the sons of Israel forever. And the house of Israel will not again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings by their harlotry and by the corpses of their kings when they die. What's that? That's the end of their sin. This is the new covenant. This is Jeremiah 31. This is when he takes away their sin. This is Romans 11, 25, when he takes away their sin. By setting their threshold by my threshold and their doorpost beside my doorpost, with the only wall between me and them, and they have defiled my holy name by their abominations which they have committed, so I have consumed them in my anger. Now let them put away their harlotry, the corpses of their kings far from me, and I will dwell among them forever. And then he talks about the house. Look at verse 12. This is the law of the house. Its entire area and the top of the mountain all around shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house. This is the anointing of the Most Holy. It's the coming of the Messiah to His temple. His temple, His millennial temple, the one that's desecrated just before He returns. The one that is built and that the Antichrist desecrates. The Messiah removes Him from and ends the transgression and anoints the Most Holy. He comes into His temple, which He says, the Messiah will come into His temple. It says that. Now, briefly, kind of wrap this up. Hard to do. To make an end of sins and to seal up vision and prophecy. Now, one of the reasons I call this a chiasm is because these two verbs happen to be the same word, which points to me to chiasm. To make an end of sins is literally, in the Hebrew, to seal up sins. And then it says, to seal up vision and prophecy. And I suggest those two go together. It's the removal of sins which will end the need of prophecy. Now, that's not arbitrary. Turn over to Jeremiah 31. Speaking of the new covenant, notice the removal of sins and the end of prophecy go together. They go hand in hand. Surprise, surprise. Jeremiah 31, verse 33, But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it. By the way, where does the Word of God come from? Prophets, right? He says, I'm going to write the Word on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. That reminds you of Ezekiel, which we just read. Verse 34, They will not teach again each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they will all know me. That's prophecy. That's what the prophets did. So that the end, there is no more need of prophecy because the law is now written on the hearts. For they will all know me from the least to them to the greatest, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity and their sin I will remember no more. Zechariah 12, 14 talks about the same thing. There is no more need for prophets when their sin is removed. Those two go together. And then, lastly, in the middle, and most significantly, I love this passage, he talks about make reconciliation for iniquity or atonement for iniquity and bring everlasting righteousness. Now, the word is kafar, atone. Atone for iniquity. And he's talking about the removal of the wrath of God, which is what Daniel prayed for in verse 16 when he said, Lord, when will your wrath be turned away from your people? The answer is here. Israel will be reconciled to God. Something that hasn't happened yet. It's based on the cross. They will look at their Messiah whom they pierced, but it hasn't happened yet in time. And then to bring in everlasting righteousness is the natural consequence. Look at Jeremiah chapter 23, which again we've looked at. Verse 5, speaking of the Messiah. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he will reign as king, act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. Now please, just let me point out, this is the same moment in time that's spoken of by Daniel when the kingdom comes. It's the same moment in time spoken of by Zechariah 14 when Christ comes and becomes king over the whole earth. It's the same moment of time when righteousness comes in, when righteousness dwells over the whole earth, when righteousness is the means by which the Messiah reigns, and he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved, and Israel will dwell securely. And this is his name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. We could look at, there's so many passages that come to mind, but I want to put, these all come together. They come together beautifully. They come together wonderfully. Now let me close by reading two passages that speak of exactly what these six things are talking about. Look at Isaiah chapter 12. I'm just going to read these and then I'll quit. This is Israel's song after Isaiah chapter 11 takes place. That's why it starts out with then. It's referring back to chapter 11. And chapter 11 is about the kingdom, when the kingdom comes. And verse 12, he says, then, or chapter 12, then will you say on that day, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, for although you were angry with me, your anger is turned away. That's atonement. That's the turning away of wrath. And you comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid, for the Lord God is my strength and song. He has become my salvation. Therefore, you will joyously draw water from the springs of salvation, and in that day you will say, give thanks to the Lord, call on his name, make known his deeds among the peoples, make them remember that his name is exalted, praise the Lord in his song, for he has done excellent things. Let this be known throughout the earth. Cry aloud and shout for joy, O inhabitant of where? Zion. That's Jerusalem. Daniel 9. For great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. In your midst, where's their midst? The sanctuary. The sanctuary that will be anointed. Now, an even better one yet. This came to mind. This is a phenomenal passage. Psalm 85. You understand, this is what all the Old Testament was looking toward. Understand, it was accomplished at the cross, but it didn't come into fruition at the cross because the Jews rejected their Messiah. It's the beauty of the whole plan. It's God's plan. It's absolutely phenomenal. Psalm 85 brings these two together. This is interesting to me. Let me just point out, before I read this, and I'm going to close with this. If you look at Daniel 9 and these six things, the two middle ones are reconciliation of iniquity and what? The bringing in of righteousness. In other words, peace with God and righteousness. Okay? Now keep that in mind as you read Psalm 85. This is the Jews looking for the day of salvation that would come someday. O Lord, you showed favor to your land. You restored the captivity of Jacob. You forgave the iniquity of your people. You covered all their sin. That's atonement. You withdrew all your fury. You turned away from your burning anger. Restore us, O God, of our salvation, and cause your indignation toward us to cease. Now he asks a question that, to be honest with you, the Jews are still asking. Will you be angry with us forever? Will you prolong your anger to all generations? Surely the Jews are still asking this question. There's still a reproach. They are still persecuted by the whole world. They are still facing hatred everywhere. Will you not yourself revive us again, that your people may rejoice in you? Show us your loving kindness, O Lord, and grant us your salvation. I will hear what God the Lord will say, for he will speak peace to his people, to his godly ones, but let them not turn back to folly. That's the end of their sin, right? Surely his salvation is near to him who fears him, that glory may dwell in your land, in our land. Loving kindness and truth have met together, righteousness and peace have kissed each other. That's what happens in the day that Israel's saved. That's what's right in the middle of this chiasm. Indeed, the Lord will give what is good, and our land will yield its produce. What's that? That's the kingdom. Righteousness will go before him and will make his footsteps into a way. Daniel 9, 24, 20 through 27 is talking about the day when the kingdom will come to Israel, when the righteousness will come into the land, when their sins will be removed forever, when they will experience the glory that was promised throughout the Old Testament. And it's still coming. It's coming when Christ returns. It's a wonderful picture. It's absolutely a phenomenal statement of the glory of God. The 70 weeks of Daniel. Well, we'll look at some of the detail of the time, hopefully, Lord willing, next week. Just a couple, I know this was a little long, but any questions or thoughts? If not, let's close in a word of prayer. Father, again, we would just bow before you and acknowledge your greatness, your goodness, your holiness. We acknowledge the depth of your thoughts. We acknowledge the depth of your word, and we acknowledge that we are dependent upon you to understand it. Father, I pray that you would put in our hearts a great desire for your return. May we delight in your second coming, indeed as much as we delight in your first coming. We know that everything you have accomplished for us, you accomplished at the cross. Yet we also know that there's a great fulfillment yet ahead. And it is just as magnificent as your first coming. And may our eyes be fixed upon your soon return. And may we delight to see our King and our God when he comes. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.